Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. To think that I went back to 2019 to find the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and I thought, oh my God, we need to hear this over and over again. And we've been doing it now for months, and I want his testimony during the impeachment hearings ringing in your ears. But I look back to the last couple of months, he's got so much competition, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. We could almost play a different piece of testimony every single day between now and November of 2020, and the cacophony in your ears would be driving you nuts. But I made the commitment to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and I keep my word. So now, the powerful testimony during the impeachment hearing of 2019, the GOP were fools. They should have impeached him then. They would have had President Pence, and at least things would be less toxic. All right, now, Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
One of my favorite days of the week is Monday. And I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Sunday, so I guess I should say Sunday afternoon is my favorite day of the week. But the reason why I love Monday is I get to rethink the week. And I always bring together some interesting voices. And we're beginning to mix it up a little, which is kind of exciting. And we're finding voices that we use on a regular basis that we bring into our Rethink the Week. I've just started cultivating some new people who just got their PhDs on Thursday, believe it or not. They defended on Thursday. And I told my young new PhD, Matt Nelson, you're coming on to Rethink the Week in 2 weeks. So it's been very exciting. But let me introduce my guests. We have Dean Spiliotis. He's kind of like our anchor. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. I have known him forever. He has a blog site called nhpoliticalcapital.com. You also hear him as a regular on their end of the week roundup on NHPR. Welcome, Dean. Let me also welcome our other two guests. We have joining us from UNH Manchester. He's also a fellow at the Carsey Institute of Public Policy, Stephen Pimpare. I want to welcome Stephen back. How are you, Steve?
Hi, Arnie. I have no idea how to answer that question.
Yeah, I guess I should never ask that question anymore. We won't be able to answer that question until a week after the election, because by that time, maybe we'll have a result. So, but welcome back. And joining us for the first, well, actually not the first time. I think you've done this before, Robert Hennelly. Robert Hennelly, you can find him at Stuck Nation. He writes for The Chief Leader. You write for InsiderNJ.com. And you have been one of the fixtures, both in New Jersey and in New York, on the media landscape. Let me welcome you to the program. How are you, Bob?
Feeling more flexible than a fixture.
Oh, more flexible than a fixture. Well, very good. It's so funny. The first thing I posted when I sent you guys the stuff was the tweet about minding the gap. And it's about the gap in the United States between the number of people who contracted COVID, whatever. And now that Europe is basically saying, don't even bother coming. You know, I laugh because mind the gap was, you know, whenever you're on the train station in the UK, you'd always hear the British guy over there, mind the gap. And I've got like t-shirts and pocketbooks. I'm gonna have to start using them now.
We are the gap.
Yeah, only if they put COVID-19. So I'm on the phone this morning talking to my daughter in Shanghai. And this is the one that's pregnant. And she basically said that the likelihood is China will not allow Americans in till maybe the end of 2021, maybe 2022. And she was weeping, because that means I will not see my first grandchild until she may be like, you know, a toddler, which is just shocking. So I asked Stephen, how are you? And you weren't sure how to answer that question. I think none of us are sure how to answer the question because there isn't a safety valve anywhere. I feel like the entire political, economic, health, social, climate landscape is literally imploding, Stephen, simultaneously, which is what is, in a way, it's synergistic. It seems to make everything else more acute. And I know Bob has written a lot in the last couple of days about what's happened as a result of Black Lives Matter, reconsidering names on buildings, reconsidering what's our relationship with the police, looking at statues coming down, sort of finally having a come to Jesus moment about a historical past that we were never taught. And that was intentional, Steve. You know, as everyone reminds me, it's the winners who write the history. And in this case, it isn't just that it was white men. It was white men with wealth who extracted their wealth from a lot of people that were the winners. And I feel because of social media, because of Black Lives Matter, because of TikTok, we are learning history on the fly. But in a matter of 1 month, more people have learned about the history they were never taught than any moment in time. I'm kind of sort of shocked by what I'm seeing, but yet I'm really feeling like it's an educational moment.
It is, for me anyway, sort of the thing that actually keeps me going in 2020 is sort of the Black Lives Matter movements in the forms that they're taking really is the thing that gives me hope right now. That said, I think it's important that we highlight that it's a whole lot of people knew this history, right, and did not need to be taught it. What's happening is that white people who have maintained power and control are finding it increasingly difficult to live in denial of that exceedingly obvious history that has always been available for those of us who care to find it, read it, know it, and think about what it means for us. I think it is all to the good, but I think that we need to recognize that this so-called learning moment is in fact another instantiation of white supremacy playing out.
No, you're and Robert, you cover New Jersey and New York, so we need to talk about this. Because when I was looking at what happened at Princeton with the removal of Woodrow Wilson's name, I discovered that they had tried to do that 4 years ago.
Indeed.
Okay, I just want people to know this. See, as Stephen is mentioning, this is not a new awakening. A lot of people know this history. A lot of people have been knocking on the doors. A lot of people are saying, take this name down, take this statue down, doing whatever. But they were totally ignored, Robert. And then to suddenly realize at this moment, finally, what had, you know, been asked for 4 years ago for exactly the same raison d'etre is now being heard today. That is monumental, Bob.
Yeah, the tide wasn't high enough. I think also it's important to look at the fact that Woodrow Wilson offers us a real window. This is not the first time that we've had a president in a White House with protesters in Lafayette Square using the police to suppress protests, who was in full denial about a pandemic tearing through the United States and the rest of the planet. This was Woodrow Wilson, same circumstance, which history has kind of just de-emphasized.
Wow, that's, between that and the segregationist that he was, and when he was president of Princeton, he denied African-Americans the ability to enroll in Princeton during the 8 years he was president of Princeton. I mean, the stuff I am learning about Woodrow Wilson, it's exhausting, but you're absolutely right about the pandemic. It would be interesting, Dean Spiliotis, if you could almost do a split screen and have Woodrow Wilson over here and Donald Trump over there and let people see that by not learning that history, we were doomed to repeat that history. They say that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Donald Trump is a real rhyme to Woodrow Wilson.
Well, it most definitely repeats itself. But can you hear me okay, by the way?
Absolutely.
Sound good? Okay, glad. Absolutely. Little technical difficulties. History certainly repeats itself. I think whenever we go through these major cultural moments, I do think there's a lot of learning that goes on. People find out about aspects of our history that they either were not familiar with, didn't pay attention to, sometimes even makes them rethink fundamental assumptions about how our society functions. And that's always a good thing. This whole recent theme with the Trump campaign, I read somewhere somebody referred to President Trump as trying to be the last president of the Confederacy. Maybe a little bit hyperbolic, but as his overtures to talking about a cultural heritage and whiteness and white nationalism, etc., in these sort of oblique and sometimes less oblique ways, it really is quite remarkable to watch all the phrases, law and order, cultural heritage, et cetera, et cetera. It's all the kind of signifying words that are often used currently. So I think this is a good learning moment for people. I do think it's having an effect on how some people view the choice coming up in November. And then there's also this other argument about how to move forward culturally in terms of, denaming institutions, taking down statues, et cetera.
So, it's really interesting, Stevie, because one of the things that Donald Trump apparently signed an executive order to protect the monuments. Does he have authority to do that? Like, could he go into Bob, you told me that Newark took down Christopher Columbus. Yeah. Who cares what Donald Trump does with the executive order? it's not his statue, it's Newark's. Who cares in Providence, Rhode Island? It's not his statue, it's Providence. I mean, look what he's doing. I mean, this is a piece of paper with, for the most part, very little meaning, I think, Stephen Pinter.
Well, it applies only to monuments that are on federal land, as you might expect, given, as you just said, that he doesn't have jurisdiction over other places. And as I understand, it was merely a directive that the Department of Justice prioritize the enforcement of already existing law as it relates to those kinds of things placed on federal land. So, as is the case with lots of those signing statements that the president is so fond of, they sometimes have real power and meaning, sometimes are symbolic acts which also have power and meaning, right? I mean, the President of the United States signifying that he is more concerned with the well-being of monuments to the Confederacy than he is with the well-being of actually existing Americans tells us something important.
Right. Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Yes, just a little bit. You folks are talking about how this is a big learning experience for a lot of Americans, and God knows that it is a big learning experience because a lot of people didn't know our history. But I think also for a lot of other people, white people in particular, this is an application of the expression, please don't look away. I've done a lot of immigration witnessing, and we see the children in cages, and we see the refugees that are sent back across the border into terrible camps in Mexico. And the idea of witnessing is don't look away. We can't just pretend that this isn't happening. And I think the same thing has been true with America's racial history. It's not that people don't know that African Americans are being discriminated against. It's not that people don't see it all the time in their daily lives. It's that you sort of choose to look away. You choose to put your head in the sand and say, well, it's not my business. Somebody else can take care of it. Are saying, I can't live with a country like this.
Well, but Bob, one of the things they keep saying is say their names. Say their names. That's the reason for saying their names. Why do we now have on the one block from the White House, Black Lives Matter painted on the street? Why do we now have, I believe, in front of Trump Tower in New York City? I think Mayor de Blasio is about to put Black Lives Matter in front of Trump Tower. Part of it isn't that people are being told not to avert their eyes. People are being told to articulate the names, because without saying the names, it's a number. It's generic. It's not, it doesn't have a pulse. It doesn't have a family. It doesn't cry. It doesn't bleed. And I think it's also important for us to sort of connect the humanity of the moment. And I think that's what's really happening here, is that we may know generically this statistic, but now we're connecting it to the humanity.
I think also that we can't ignore the confluence of the racial implications of the COVID pandemic. And the fact that this came at a time of for much of the Northeast, an unprecedented introspection where people were literally left with themselves and their families in a primordial way that we haven't seen in over a century. And it's also important to know that back in the 1918 period, it was Alice Paul and making the point that women's lives matter in front of Lafayette Park, right, that gave Wilson similar agita. There's something about this kind of thing of having this significant threat to the human condition that causes upon us some kind of reflection about mortality and our broader social circumstance, especially when it's brought home that the essential workforce that's keeping the cartoon going is so largely constituted of people of color who have often been, have had the hardest time getting healthcare and getting a living wage.
You know, you mentioned COVID and you mentioned its impact on especially the African-American community. The numbers are just staggering when you look at it. But of course, when you understand the health disparities leading into COVID-19, it is of no surprise to anyone, unfortunately, because again, another thing that it's a number, but now the number has a real consequence in the way of death. They said that the number of African-Americans that know someone who's died from COVID compared to white people who have known someone who dies from COVID, the number is astronomically different. Okay, it's just remarkable. But Dean, I want to make COVID the political fight it is today, because it's not just killing people. It's not just now spreading in Texas and spreading in Florida and coming back in California. And it's just shocking what we're seeing in the way of numbers. But in a way, Trump's denial of COVID-19 is both classic Trump, I don't own anything that's wrong. The other thing is, Dean, is that he's actually causing mayhem and death within his base. So they said that when he was at Tulsa, he ordered them to take down all the signs that said, keep your distance 6 feet. Not only were they like kind of discouraged from wearing masks, not only were there only 6,000 out of 19,000, but in a lot of ways, anything you could do to prevent the spread, he overtly did the opposite. And I'm wondering, does he want to kill them? Does he not like them? Does he want to lose because so many of them will contract this disease? It is so amazing because it's become an interesting weapon in his hands. It's not just an illness. He's weaponizing it, but in a bizarre way, he's weaponizing it against his very base, Dean Spiliotis.
Well, I will say it's been torturous the last few days watching some of the administration officials try to square his behavior with the broader policies of the CDC, of the coronavirus task force, et cetera. I've seen most of the major players on TV over the last few days, and it must be exhausting to try to talk about the need to socially distance and wear masks and all the kinds of things that the CDC is recommending, yet also have to defend President Trump's behavior. And there is video of that rally in Tulsa where his staffers took the social distance stickers off of every other chair in order to allow people to be closer. And then, you know, I think my favorite comment, and I use that sarcastically, of the entire episode was, I think it was in the church rally, it was that in Arizona, the second rally he did, where he made a comment, if you listen, he said, we were doing well during the plague, and now we're doing well after the plague. So in his mind, he's already moved past it. And as I said before, I think it's a way to link, because in his mind, we need to get back to normal so that the economy can do better, so that he can get reelected. And I don't think it's that he's even thinking that strategically. I don't think he really cares or thinks about the broader implications. But it really has gotten to the point of almost, it's ridiculous to watch. If you watched Vice President Pence this morning on television, if you watched Secretary Azar, the twists and turns in their logic, in order to defend what he's doing at the same time that they're trying to push a more sobering message, it's crazy. I mean, it's just remarkable to see.
Well, but Stephen, I'm looking at the HHS secretary, Health and Human Services secretary. The window is closing to stop coronavirus spread. So clearly, some people are now finding their spine, finding their voice, saying, screw you. I need to have a life after November of 2020. I am not going to be in this collective denial. But Stephen, what he is doing, however, is absolutely setting up Republican governors to fail. What he is doing in Florida with the Republican governor, what he is doing in Texas with the Republican governor, what he is doing around the country is so detrimental. If you really believe, let the governors be on their own and make the decisions because he doesn't want to own the decision, that would be one thing. But Stephen, he does the opposite. He says, let the governors decide. And then he basically threatens the governors. So the governors basically tie themselves into knots and don't give the really full-throated authority that they should be given to talk about masking or closing or doing whatever. I mean, Governor Abbott is the perfect example of this incredibly weak response and tortured response. And Texas is so freaking important to the GOP.
And you know, this is a global pandemic, and here it's got national implications. It is not amenable to local solutions, right? If there were ever a time when it would be helpful to have a functioning national government taking control, marshaling resources, communicating clear, consistent messages to the public at all levels so that people knew how to behave, working with Congress in order to ensure that people were not making the choice between their economic livelihood and their literal livelihood, which is the box that we're putting people in, right? All of these schools and universities, my own including, considering whether they're going to open up in the fall, right? It's because they've been put in a box where their only choice is to confront dead community members or failed institutions, right? So we've got sort of this failure at all levels. Going back to the observation that Dean was making, I think that, you know, we have now had how many former members of the administration and current members on background tell us the same story? They can't get him to pay attention. He's not present for briefings. He doesn't pay attention. They dumb them down. They make them shorter and shorter. They put more and more graphics. They put more and more pictures. They can't do it. They can't get him to focus. They can't get him to pay attention. He gets an idea in his head and he is surrounded by some of the smartest people on the planet explaining to him why he is wrong. He won't let go the idea, right? I think Dean is right that to talk about strategic efforts here probably makes no sense when we're talking about Trump. This does not seem to be a human who thinks strategically. But the incompetence now has always been there, right? But we are now seeing the consequences in these almost indescribable ways. And absent his removal from office, I don't see it getting any better.
So, Robert, I want to actually start with you at the very beginning of the second segment, but I want to just throw this out there. I think he wants to lose. I think he hates the job. I think he wants to sort of have everything burned down behind him. But what really scares me, Robert, is that when he first won the election in 2016, I kept thinking, this is a replay of The Producers. You know, they did everything to fail. Nobody will show up for the Broadway production. It's about Hitler. It's about all these things. And then, of course, they're wildly successful. And I am just terrified, Bob, that in every effort he is making to be so across the board destructive, that the result might be he still wins. And when we come back from the break, you got to tell me it's not going to happen because I am so terrified at how distorted the political landscape is that I'm not even sure how to gauge politics going forward. And that, I think, is what is so frightening. All right, this is the first half of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be joined right after the break by Dean Spiliotis, Robert Henley, and Stephen Pimpare. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Smith Act. Some initially dubbed it the Harry Bridges Law after the radical labor leader, long targeted by the FBI for deportation. Politicians claimed it was designed to prosecute fascists, Nazis, and communists. In fact, the Smith Act was first used to prosecute and convict Minneapolis Teamster leaders and supporters of the Socialist Workers' Party, recognized for their successful 1934 strike and radical leadership. Named after the Virginia Democratic Representative Howard W. Smith, it was originally titled entitled the Alien Registration Act of 1940. In addition to mandating the registration and fingerprinting of resident aliens, it allowed for the deportation of those resident aliens who sought to overthrow the government by force. But the act also extended to those citizens who advocated the overthrow of the government by force or violence, or engaged in the printing, publishing, or distributing of materials that advocated sedition. And it made it illegal for citizens to organize or belong to any association that engaged in such activity. According to historian Donna Haverty Stack, author of Trotskyists on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR, the Smith Act was a peacetime anti-sedition law that marked a dramatic shift in the legal definition of free speech protection in America. The Minneapolis case shows how far the administration went to prosecute political dissent, even to the point of targeting the labor liberal left. The Smith Act served as a prime tool for the McCarthyite Red Scare, and it was used to prosecute more than 100 communists and labor leaders. Finally, in a landmark 1957 Supreme Court case, Yates versus the United States, convictions under the Smith Act were rendered unconstitutional.
It's just the same old song and dance, the same old song and dance. Turns out you never cared at all. Turns out you bounced me like a ball. Whoever thought I'd fall the same old song and dance. It's just the same old smooth routine, the same old moonlit scene. Turns out you only use those eyes simply to sell me all those lies. I really went king size for the same old song.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude, officially known as Rethink the Week, with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. All right, Robert, put me on the couch. Give me some credit.
I think that actually we should take President Trump at face value and be a literalist. He said that he told them to slow down the testing because when you have testing, you get results which show people have disease. That's only part of the issue.
Right.
One of the things that's been blacked out because for whatever reason the corporate news media doesn't want to talk about labor unions is the federal government's abject failure to test any of the 2 million personnel that they employ. So you have people who are at the TSA, on the front lines of the airports, people in congregate living facilities like the VA and the Bureau of Prisons, who have not been tested, because to be tested means to get bad news. I submit to you that he still adheres to the naturalist Malthusian approach of herd immunity, despite the fact that brother Boris Johnson almost died because of it. And even though medical research is increasingly telling us that there's no confidence about herd immunity, we don't even know if it exists. I submit to you that he firmly believes that that's the thing that will save him and indeed his economy.
So Robert, are you
arguing that he is not incompetent?
Well, no, I think that he's incompetent, but that he's committed.
Fair enough. No, I'm genuinely curious.
No, he's. Oh God, this is so scary. So you mentioned, Bob, and since you do cover unions, I just want to touch on this issue before we go to the rest of the guys. And that is, you mentioned the TSA. So I saw a TSA whistleblower who was talking about all the things that are happening at the TSA. And the one place that you would want people to have gloves and masks and be tested every day would be the person who says, take off your shoes, let me check you out, let me, you know what I mean? I mean, if you're gonna get any kind of travel back, the TSA are the most important gatekeepers, more than people that work on the planes, more than people that fly on the planes. It is the TSA that basically touches all of you and all of your stuff.
It's so bad, because one of the key things here is that there needs to be a 9/11 equivalent commission about this after pestilence leaves.
Yes. And
the reason why I say this is I was writing stories in the beginning of March where the union representatives, this first stepped off in Heathrow, where transit workers doing the same job as the TSA in London were encountering the virus. And so at that time, there's letters, we put them in the paper, from AFG, Dr. Everett Kelly, who's the president of that union, warning that they needed to take measures. This is something that the first responders and frontline people were warning about. In fact, back on March 11th, the New York Nurses Association warned that the downgrading of N95 masks that the CDC did, because they wanted to manage inventory. You know, before this, it's so important to remember this, if you used an N95 for more than one clinical encounter, you got written up in a hospital.
Yes, exactly.
The CDC decided you should adopt it as a pet and carry it around in your lunch bag and they predicted that it would, one, kill healthcare workers and make hospitals the vector for the disease. Yes. What happened?
So Dean, the reason I mentioned the TSA is that the airline industry is apoplectic because they're trying to figure out how to create safety, how to make money, you know, whether they should get rid of the middle seat, but no, maybe we can't get rid of the middle seat. They're doing all these things to try to make the situation better. What I'm trying to figure out is, if you know what this whistleblower has exposed to the TSA, why hasn't the airline industry gone to Donald Trump and threatened him? And I mean, by saying, you must test them daily. You must give them the necessary equipment. This has got consequences. The airline technically isn't responsible for the TSA, but the TSA is responsible for an economic return to the airline industry.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's clearly a disconnect there. There has been in the past, you know, as you said, the TSA is viewed as a, you know, part of the governmental bureaucracy. The airline industry is fascinating. I mean, it's going to be years before they get back to pre-COVID volume of travel. And you know, we're seeing now there's some consternation over, I think, United Airlines and American Airlines have announced they're going to start booking at 100% capacity. Although I think you'll have an opportunity to move to a less crowded plane if you'd like. I just think there are real, you know, there's only so much you can do to make air travel safe. There's going to be some risk. If you decide to take that risk, there's just going to be some risk. You know, the exact level of that risk, you know, there's going to be debate over it. But you are seeing more people flying, although, you know, volume is still something like 80 or 85% below what it had been. But, you know, the TSA, that should be an easy fix. I mean, that should be an obvious thing to focus on in terms of the front line. So it just kind of adds insult to injury.
Well, and that's kind of my point, Stephen, is that if you start connecting those dots, I can't believe every CEO of every major airline says, this has got to be done. And not only are we seeing it's going to be years before the airline industry is even back to, I don't know what normal is going to look like going into the future, but now you've got the EU basically telling America, don't bother showing up. And what is remarkable to me is the three countries, and specifically that they're talking about, you know, the big countries are US, Brazil, and Russia. Those are the three that they're basically, I mean, there are other countries as well, but those are the prominent ones. How bizarre, I mean, because so much of airline traffic is to places like Europe. And now Europe is basically saying, we're going to seal our borders to you.
You know, I think a lot of people have been struggling with sort of trying to think through sort of who in which positions of power could have a meaningful chance of influencing the response, particularly of the federal government. And it's, you know, it's hard to come up with an answer knowing what we know of the president, right? So it's like, why don't airline executives, right, gather together and speak out and make some noise? Well, we don't know what they're doing behind the scenes. We don't know what kinds of negotiations they're trying to engage in with the administration. We know they still want more money out of Congress. That means a Republican-controlled Senate, so they need to be careful not to be alienating Republicans who are aligned with the president. I mean, sort of the minute you start to think this through, I've had the same thing sort of wondering about Anthony Fauci, right? Was there a moment sort of at the peak of his public attention when he could have resigned in protest and maybe formed, right, a shadow cabinet outside the government of experts that he assembled in order to try to communicate more broadly? I don't know, right? I don't know what horrors he has prevented from happening by working quietly, diligently behind the scenes and trying to walk, again, as so many in the administration are, right? This impossible line of doing the right thing while making sure to massage the president's ego. And I do not envy that job.
I don't know, but Bob, you know so much about these unions. You've been writing about them. This is your area of expertise. And I go back to the TSA. So if we know from this whistleblower what's happening, that they are now a vector for spread, if we know the airline industry needs to have a trust in the TSA that they will not be, because before you get on the plane, you have to go through the TSA. When you leave the plane, you go through, I mean, all right. So they become the very, very critical gatekeepers. How can the airline industry go back to the feds and the GOP asking for money to bail them out when one of the problems they have is a TSA that can't be trusted and isn't a vector for spread? I mean, it's like this is not that complicated, but it kind of is. Because, you know, you don't want to offend the president, but yet you're asking for more money. But why would I give you more money if I know what we're doing with the TSA is making it impossible for you to get stable again economically? I'm exhausted.
But there's only one thing you left. There's only one thing you left out of your analysis, which is that Majority Leader Moscow Mitch is pressing to hold a lovely indemnification for all of industry from any COVID-related litigation. I think it's also important to dial back and remember very early on, you know, the Times today had this very important story about how everyone was surprised about the connection between asymptomatic circumstances and the spread of COVID. And so a narrative develops, like we just learned it. A brick just hit us in the head. We didn't know we were innocents. Well, I can take you back to before anybody was told to stay at home, when a flight crew for JetBlue, represented by Transportation Workers Union, okay, they're in New York. They bring a guy down who's just been COVID tested, doesn't know the results, and is a real humanitarian. He gets the results when the plane lands and finds out that he is COVID positive. And then he informs the crew, maybe he didn't want to hang around the carousel to get his luggage, and they spear him off with an EMT crew. At that point, JetBlue wanted to put this flight crew back into service. And they said, we can't do that because we will spread the disease, even though we're asymptomatic. So we have seen working people get this right consistently and the government frustrate their efforts to protect themselves.
Exactly.
MTA has lost 130 individuals in the subway system in New York. They wanted to wear masks and were wearing masks in February. And they were written up because it didn't go with their uniform.
So I want to get, let's stick on the asymptomatic. Because now what we're seeing is there was an article that said, why is the South and West different in their COVID-19 spike compared to like California and the Northeast? And it turns out it's a lot of young people. Okay, and that we're finding the numbers are just growing, Dean, with young people, right? And that's really concerning. But a lot of them, as Bob points out, are asymptomatic. Did you see this story? I just want everyone to, all my asymptomatic 27-year-olds, please listen to this. Asymptomatic COVID-19 patients can still develop lung damage. Oh, Dean, you don't show symptoms, but the coronavirus can inflict silent lung damage, which does not result in shortness of breath or cough, but may have long-term consequences. Mm-hmm. Dean, they think that they have, even if they, you know, they brought it home to grandma and she dies, and even though they may be a spreader, they think they're, you know, fine because they didn't have symptoms and they're asymptomatic. And now, even with asymptomatic, it turns out there may be long-term consequences. Do you think this story is going to come out of Pence's mouth? Do you think this story is going to come out of even Dr. Fauci, for that matter? These are the stories that are just so consequential, because when we're looking at the South and the West, there is a rise in that young group. A lot of them are asymptomatic, but there's a real problem. There's a real problem, and for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you heard Dr. Fauci say the other day at the press conference that He has never seen anything like this virus in the sense of the kind of the broad array of impacts that it can literally be asymptomatic in one person, and then another person ends up in the ICU on a ventilator and or worse. And there's just a range of ways in which you can damage your body, your vital organs, your cardiopulmonary system. It's just the whole thing is just very scary. We're still learning about it. The issue obviously to some extent has been among, and you know, the one of the subtext debates is about whether or not it's in these states that are really struggling now, Florida, Texas, Arizona. They were all states that opened up pretty quickly, didn't meet the guidelines. You know, in fairness, virtually, I don't think any of the states met all of the gating criteria. But we're learning a lot about how highly contagious this disease is, particularly in indoors, in close quarters. Bars and indoor restaurants and bars are going to be real hot spots, and we're seeing anywhere where there's congregation in close quarters, indoors in particular, you're going to have a real problem. And so, you know, whereas with New York, with this shelter in place order, you had young folks staying in as well. What we've seen now, I mean, everyone has seen the videos and the pictures of, you know, hundreds of people socializing and at high volume talking over music. All of that stuff indoors is particularly problematic in bars.
So I got 2 points, Stephen, because I'm thinking about this. I interviewed a guy who I think he was a professor from like North Carolina, South Carolina. And he was talking about how air conditioning changed the South. That before air conditioning, everything was slow. Everybody was kind of limp. There wasn't a lot of manufacturing because it was too freaking hot, okay? But AC comes in and the South changes. It becomes this economic oasis because you could always leave the 102 degrees outside and come into a nice cool 72, and it changed. So I'm looking at the South and the West, and I'm going to tell you a couple of things. I know we can eat outside in New Hampshire. We can eat outside in New York. But when it's 104 in Texas, when it's 99 in Florida, you ain't eating a mountain. So it's, I think, another reason why we're seeing this greater rise and spike in places like the South and the West is the nature of their weather and how they congregate. They don't congregate outside. They congregate to escape the heat. And that turns out to be the worst location if you're trying to socially distance, if you're going to try to wear a mask. How do you eat and wear a mask in a place where the AC may be circulating everybody sick?
Or it's going to turn out to be something else, right? This goes back to sort of the enormous difficulty that experts have had in getting a handle on the virus itself. But, you know, and you know, I look at those pictures and video, and I've got friends in New York who will, you know, be out for their quick run to the grocery store and send me photos of people gathering together, right, in public spaces. But, you know, and again, this goes back for me that I am less inclined to blame individuals under those circumstances than I am inclined to blame government, right? It's that we know through decades and decades worth of research in political psychology, in political science, and other disciplines, right, that when there is a divided message emerging from elites, right, that's when you have wildly divergent public opinion. Right?
Exactly.
Because you latch on to, right, sort of different places you go, right? Public Health 101 guideline for any emergent epidemic: find a message, make sure it's emerging consistently and clearly from every possible source in the same way, communicate to people that your knowledge is emerging, build trust so that when you need to alter recommendations, everybody is doing it simultaneously. You're telling people how, you're telling people why, right? So just sort of basic, make sure that people know how and what to do. We've not done any of that, right? We've not done any of that. So on the one hand, am I angry at people in my local supermarket, right, showing up without masks and walking the wrong way down the one-way aisle? Yeah. On the other, it's like, I can understand why it is that they do not know what sensible behavior is. And I am much more inclined to point to institutional failure at a massive scale than I am at individual responsibility.
If you mentioned government, Bob, Biden said that he would, that when he became president, he would have an executive order mandating face masks in all public facilities. Nancy Pelosi came out and said, right after Biden said that, that she supports mandatory face masks, right? So, of course, there's the Pence, Trump, GOP, free staters who talk about the fact that mandating me to wear a face mask is a violation of my free speech, right? That's the threat. You know, if it isn't the Second Amendment, it's now the First Amendment, but not the way I interpreted the First Amendment with the idea of freedom of speech. So here's my question, Bob, and I want us to sort of talk about this, and maybe I need to find a constitutional law professor to answer my question, but I posted on Facebook the following. You know how it is illegal to go into a crowded theater and scream fire? And the reason that that is not considered free speech is because you know that we'll probably start this incredible exiting, that people might be harmed and killed as a result of this. So there is a potential lethal consequence to you screaming, you know, fire in a crowded theater. How is the idea of not wearing a mask not similar to screaming fire in a crowded theater? Since we know from all the scientists, and now we know from all the medical professionals, and now we've actually seen people with a mask, without a mask, spitting, coughing, talking, whatever, you can sort of see the spread of the disease. How is that considered free speech? And how come there hasn't been a lawsuit about it? I mean, maybe the courts will be terrified, but I'm looking at this, and that's how they're wrapping themselves up. The flag of choice now is the reason I don't want you to tell me to wear my mask is because it's my free speech right.
I want to build on something that Stephen was getting at, which is the betrayal by the government of the public trust. You're talking about the wearing of the mask. I think we need to go back to the primary issue of how this risk has been represented to the American people and how contradictory that has been. The mask is a response to a circumstance, but we have not reached consensus nor been consistent about that circumstance. Case in point would be the CDC initially saying that masks should only be worn by first responders and by the sick. If you're healthy, there's no need to wear a mask. We're doing inventory control. Then scroll ahead, everybody needs a mask. Then look at the fact that just recently they slipped in, CDC did. By the way, COVID may be 10 times worse than we realized. How do you wrap your head around the risk threat matrix with this constantly evolving, amorphic risk? And so the reality is that what they do in this chaos is create a situation where all that's left is this kind of dissonant discourse. That's all there is. And so I do believe that we have to get back to fundamentals and look at the fact that they're all over the place on the science on this. And as long as that's the case, it's going to be hard to develop a consensus around public behavior.
So when a hurricane comes, and I sandbag, I'm running the risk that the sandbags won't be enough. Should that be the reason why I don't sandbag? No. When hurricanes, I hate to say this, but nobody's cornered the market on knowing everything now. Everyone knows that it's evolving. When you have a hurricane, do you take the risk of putting boarding up or do you not put boards up? Do you put sandbags up or do you not put sandbags up? We don't know, but what we have to do is anticipate in order to protect the community, ourselves, our family. To not do that is derelict, I'm sorry. And the fact that I don't have all the facts, screw you, who does? I mean, I hate to say this, it's not like all of us, but at the same time, what you're doing is you're risking all of our health because you claim that you're getting, you know, not everything all at once with all the information and all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed. And I'm thinking, where in life does that happen, Bob? I know, Ken, you want to weigh in.
I was going to weigh in just on Arnie's point about the legality. And, you know, this is not free speech. There are actions that are deemed speech, like protesting, carrying a placard and walking around. You're not actually opening your mouth. But wearing a protective mask or not is not speech. But more importantly, what it is action that can affect other people's health and well-being. And the government has a right and has the authority to govern with respect to how one human being interacts with another in order to not cause harm to that other. And the example I will give you is a good one for New Hampshire. It's the government requiring people to wear helmets when they ride motorcycles. And at the beginning, when states started requiring that, a lot of people said, oh, no, you're impinging on my freedom, my liberty. I don't know if anybody said it to speak, but the government can't impinge on my liability. It's my life. I'm the one that's going to die if something happens. But yeah, you're going to die, but the rest of us are going to have traffic jams and maybe other people get into crashes and get hurt. The state will have to pay a lot of money to clean everything up and the delays.
They don't wear helmets here.
The government has the authority to issue those regulations in order to make sure that when people are interacting with each other, the public welfare is served.
Bob, let me get Bob first.
I just wanted to say that you have to go to the fact this lack of credibility the government has been decades in the making. What's very instructive is to remember what Christy Tighe Whitman told tens of thousands of first responders when they wanted to open up Lower Manhattan, get Wall Street back up and running. They said the air was safe to breathe. The 50,000 people have World Trade Center cancers, and as many people have died from World Trade Center occupational exposures from that bad advice. So that's the world. That's the official government. That's why people are skeptical.
Thank you, Robert. Yes, you want to say something.
Arnie, a couple things. Now, I think there certainly was a time where there was some confusion, as we were just discussing, about using masks. And I recall that myself when the message went from not everybody needs masks to now everybody should think about wearing masks. And they were kind of developing the advisory in real time as more empirical data came in. I mean, it feels now like we're past that moment. It's very clear now what the empirical data says about mask wearing from lots of data from Europe and certainly from Asia. And so that really doesn't seem to be the central focus of the people who are the anti-maskers, if you will. This really gets to an issue that we've talked about here before in recent months. This idea that people typically, when they don't want to wear masks, they fall back on arguments about individual rights, individual liberties, and private decision making. And that's pretty much how we make healthcare decisions in this country. We worry about our own private healthcare decisions, us and our family. There's no broader concept of public health or health in the common good. And so you're constantly butting up against issues about First Amendment rights and individual liberty. And yes, you do have those rights, but most societies also have some sense of a common good or public interest that needs to be factored into this as well. And as Ken suggested, you have motorcycle helmets, which is constantly debated. You also have no indoor smoking, seat belts. There are all kinds of issues you can point to where individual rights need to compromise with broader public health considerations.
So, Stephen, we haven't even touched on the 2020 election. And of course, I saw a really interesting story about how 2020 is not in any way, shape, or form like 2016. And the reason they said is that Joe Biden ain't Hillary Clinton. Under anybody, and that what Donald Trump needed was to have the second most disliked candidate in American history by polling to run against and to win, on top of which she happened to be female too. You know, I mean, the combination was perfect. He could work the gender issue, plus he could work her high negatives. Is that enough for Joe not to be Hillary?
Well, we'll find out. this is a finding that has been popping up in polls for a couple of months now, that one of the factors in the 2016 election is for voters who disliked both candidates, they voted Trump. And that the polling data is suggesting that for those voters who dislike both candidates this time around, they're more inclined to vote Biden. The other thing that is different is that Trump is the incumbent. We are in the midst of a global pandemic with 128,000 at least Americans dead, probably what, 250,000, 300,000, God forbid, maybe more by the time we get to Election Day, dead in a recession that, if we allow the emergency provisions to expire, will turn to depression, which will have global effects. Historically, that would incline you to suggest that the incumbents' chances are not terrific.
Hi, Robert Henley. Since you cover so much about the unions and public sector unions, especially, the people that are going to be the hardest hit next, the next wave of unemployment is going to be with public sector workers.
It's already happened. So
no cash coming in, and without cash, services have to go because you can't pay with air. So what are you hearing in places like New Jersey and New York?
Well, we have 1.5 million public workers out of work just in the last 2 months. We have Mayor de Blasio saying without $1 billion of concessions for labor, 22,000 people will have to be hit the bricks. So what you're seeing is, and in rural areas, and this is going to be problematic for Trump, in places like upstate New York, because factories left, because multinationals used U.S. tax policy to move the factories, the only job you're getting is either in the prison or in the health center, the hospital. So this is kind of an unraveling that's going to be hard to put back together in the midst of these rural areas that have already been stripped out of healthcare because we made it our real-time access to rural health, which has really taken a tremendous hit because of the way we rationed healthcare. So I think that we're building up, and there's also, I have to say, tumult in union elections. I'm seeing incumbents defeated, people that could take, so there's something that is a once in a couple of generation transformation that's happening.
Wait. You have to write an article about that. So what I'm seeing within the primary that happened in places like with Engel getting defeated by Bowman, with what happened, I think Amy McGrath may have won. I don't know if it's been finalized yet, but it was wicked close. I mean, like too close for comfort for the DNC, because she was the anointed, had more money than God. And this, you know, progressive upstart came in. And I believe, I don't know whether it's been finalized yet, but it's very close. So are you telling me that the same situation that we're seeing happening in the primary is also happening with union elections?
In union elections, I'm talking incumbent Uniform Firefighters Association guy bounced, and he didn't call the Vulcan Society. He didn't reach out to the African-American firefighters, wow, and he's done.
Wow.
So this is the head of the Corrections Officers Union. Wow. So this thing is spreading like a prairie fire, and it's not reported, but it's wide and it's deep.
I am so glad we asked that question. All right, Robert Henley, Dean Spiliotis, Stephen Pipera, fabulous conversation. We absolutely always need 3 hours. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. So.
Thanks, Arnie.
Wow, union. That's really
Thanks, folks.
Yeah, that's a great kernel of information, Bob. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right. Ciao. Take care, folks.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Open my eyes.
I will open my eyes.
I will not look away.
I will not look away.
I will use this gift I've been given every day. I have a voice. My voice is powerful. My voice can change the world. I have a voice. My voice is powerful. My voice can change the world. Change the world. I will give of myself.
I will give of myself.
I will reach out my hand.
I will reach out my hand.
I will use this heart I've been given. Take a stand.
I have a voice. My voice is powerful. My voice can change.